This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers shook up their bullpen at the Major League Baseball trade deadline. We'll find out why they traded all-star closer Josh Hader and what could be in store for the rest of the year. Now, President Biden announced earlier this week that the CIA killed a top al-Qaeda leader in a drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri is seen as a leading planner of the September 11th attacks in 2001. Here's President Biden announcing that mission.
Now, justice has been delivered, and this terrorist leader is no more. People around the world no longer need to fear the vicious and determined killer. The United States continues to demonstrate our resolve and our capacity to defend the American people against those who seek to do us harm. You know, we make it clear again tonight that no matter how long it takes, no matter where you hide, if you are a threat to our people, the United States will find you and take you out.
We're talking now about the events in Kabul this week and the wider evolution of U.S. counterterrorism policy in the decades since September 11th. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the biggest risks to national security? What do you think the United States should do to combat international terrorism, domestic terrorism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy, the use of military force, and American national security policy. He also serves as a member of the Defense Policy Board at the U.S. Department of Defense. O'Hanlon is a member of the External Advisory Board at the CIA from 2011 through 2012. His most recent book is The Art of War in an Age of Peace. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Nice to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's zoom in on the events this week. This key figure in the planning of September 11th. Can you talk a little bit about Ayman al-Zawahiri and the significance of this drone strike?
Well, first on Zawahiri, he, you know, as you know, is Egyptian and grew up in many ways protesting against his own government, involved in the assassination of Sadat four decades ago, although not a central trigger puller in that operation necessarily. So this was all part of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, a group that later wound up effectively merging with al-Qaeda. Certainly Zawahiri's role merged, and he became, of course, Osama bin Laden's deputy. So this now dates back, you know, more than 25 years. And as you know, it's about 25, 26 years since al-Qaeda declared war against the United States, which was followed up by the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. Zawahiri apparently had a role in that as mastermind, as motivator, as organizer. And of course, the 9/11 attacks, he may not have been one of the people who had his hands on the whole thing, but he was seen as one part visionary, one part organizer of the broader al-Qaeda network, recruiter, logistics specialist. You know, he just at a big ideas level, he really was central to everything that the organization was about. And so I would certainly, you know, some terrorism experts put him in really the number one spot, even ahead of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Osama bin Laden for his role in the 9/11 attacks and the sort of unique and central purpose that he played in doing all the things needed to make that attack possible. But regardless of where you put him in the pantheon, he was up there and probably the world's top surviving terrorist who is at large. Not so much in terms of what he was doing to us now, because he was spending most of his time trying to stay alive, which in the end, of course, he did not do. But because he still represented a figurehead in the organization and sort of a symbol of defiance and resilience and survival against the great satanic superpower that we purportedly are in al-Qaeda heads. He was therefore still even today, I think, a motivational presence for the organization, and his very survival itself constituted a show of some defiance against us. So in that sense, you know, I'm relieved that he's out of the picture, even though he really wasn't that active in most attacks of recent times with al-Qaeda or any other organization.
Now, this, of course, happened in Afghanistan. We had this long-running troop presence in Afghanistan that came to an end, negotiated by former President Trump, implemented in the early days of the Biden administration. And some Biden security officials are saying, pointing to this as an example, we can target terrorist figures, terrorist organizers, even in a place like Afghanistan, even without a large troop presence there. What do you think of that argument?
Well, it's true in this case. Let's hope it'll be true in other cases. You know, I don't know that this is really a great opportunity to get too overconfident. I want to give the primary credit, as I think most of us would, to the U.S. intelligence community, as opposed to a political figure who made a decision. I think President Biden made the right decision, but, you know, it's the intelligence community that did the months and years of work to figure out where this guy was. And, you know, to the extent they can repeat that phenomenal performance in regard to other terrorist leaders before those leaders are able to launch attacks against us, then we could be okay. To the extent that that feels like a little bit of a risky strategy, then again, I'd be a little bit reluctant to claim too much credit. I do think it's true that on balance, when you get somebody at that level of seniority and visibility, they're going to have a harder and harder time in the future staying away from our ability to find them, you know. But I'm worried more about sort of the places, the environments where terrorists are bred, in a sense, where they're recruited, where they do their quiet meetings before anybody knows who they are, where we don't have eyes and ears on the ground, we don't have alliances with local security forces or intelligence forces. And I fear that in those kinds of situations, figuring out who the next generation of leaders are going to be and who's the most dangerous, that's pretty hard to do from a distance. And it's a reason why I opposed the pullout from Afghanistan myself. But yes, in this case, it did work. And let's hope it'll work in the future.
And part of the negotiations for that pullout involved a commitment from the Taliban to say, we're not going to harbor international terrorist figures, especially those that present a threat to the United States. Now here's this guy in Kabul, presumably, it sounds like, with the knowledge of the Taliban. It's been suggested that means they've kind of gone back on that part of the deal. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think that it may not be all of the Taliban. It may be so-called Haqqani network, but that's a big part of the Taliban and certainly a part that we have to reckon with. You know, this is part of why most of us were pretty wary of a deal with the Taliban. We didn't think they had really changed their stripes. And, you know, on the other hand, it's not like they were encouraging Zawahiri to go attack New York again. And so maybe the Taliban thought they were sort of repaying a favor to an old friend who was at this point 71 years old, pretty harmless, really just hunkering down on his balcony, hoping for some, you know, morning air and not really going to hurt anybody. And they thought they could avoid picking a fight with us by virtue of that relatively limited, you know, refuge they provided to a longstanding friend. I'm hoping that's the way they looked at it, as opposed to the first step towards resumption of some of what they had been doing in the 1990s when they, you know, were much more active in supporting bin Laden. The real tragedy here, however, is that the Afghan people are now going to probably be condemned to an even longer period where their government is ostracized by the international community, cut off from the funds that it would like to access to prop up the Afghan economy at a time when half of Afghanistan's population is assessed by the World Food Program as being on the brink of famine or even starvation. And I was hoping that we could actually begin to reach a little bit of a modus vivendi with the Taliban. That would require some negotiations, some monitoring, and just as a way to get more food and medicine and money into Afghanistan for the good of the people. And I'm afraid that any thinking along those lines is probably now going to be postponed further, as we've seen the Taliban in cahoots with this former al-Qaeda mastermind.
Michael O'Hanlon is with us from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at U.S. counterterrorism policy around the world after the drone strike against a main al-Qaeda figure from the September 11th attacks and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Widening our scope, Mike, 20-plus years now since the September 11th attack. Big picture, what do you see changing since then in terms of the international terrorist threat to the United States?
Yeah, well, I think the simplest way to summarize is that the big plots are harder for Al-Qaeda or ISIS to carry out. The prominent ringleaders and organizers and motivators and masterminds of those organizations are mostly dead, in some cases behind bars. But the organizations continue to have a very strong presence throughout much of the broader Islamic world, especially the Middle East, especially North Africa, and some parts of South Asia. And this is primarily a threat to the people who live in those regions, because again, it's harder for these individuals to get through our multiple layers of security. We're watching for them a lot more carefully. We're devoting a lot of our intelligence resources still to the terrorist threat, as I think we have to, just to make sure that they can't reach the West. And they're still dangerous, you know, and they're still, in many cases, anxious to do a lot of the same things that they successfully achieved in the 9/11 attacks and before and after. So it's still a big problem. We haven't managed to reduce the appeal of the ideology. It's an ideology of anger and resistance and sort of, I think, false purity in Islamic terms. I think they've twisted Islam way beyond anything that's a reasonable interpretation. But unfortunately, that interpretation does appeal in some parts of the world where there's so much political anger and violence and anti-Westernism and poverty and, you know, other kinds of conditions that give rise to extremist ideology. So the ideology is alive and well, but the most gifted planners and motivators and organizers are largely now taken off the battlefield, at least in terms of this generation. And let's hope that we can, together with regional partners, make some inroads against the overall problem and popularity of these kinds of movements before the next generation figures out clever ways to attack us again.
We're talking to Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, looking at how U.S. counterterrorism policy has changed in the years since the September 11th, 2001 attacks. That following on this recent U.S. drone strike that killed a top Al-Qaeda leader who had been part of the planning for the September 11th attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want the United States to engage with the world to prevent future attacks? Do you think we've been too quick to intervene in other countries, or too quick to use drone strikes, or not using them enough? What questions you have for our guest about national security risks and responses in the U.S., call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Mike O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow and Director of Research in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, looking at the ways U.S. counterterrorism policy has shifted in recent years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think it was the right move to pull troops out of Afghanistan? Could it have gone better? What should the U.S. priorities be when it comes to counterterrorism around the world and here at home? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mike, of course, another big change after September 11th was this huge reorganization of national security and intelligence agencies into the Department of Homeland Security. Big picture, was that done effectively? Are there changes maybe that need to be done now in 2022?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, just to be clear, also, the intelligence communities remain distinct. You know, the intelligence organizations are now organized under this Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And that's a new separate sort of headquarters agency, and CIA and DIA and other agencies are still separate and independent or part of the Department of Defense to the extent they have, you know, a traditional departmental home. But the Department of Homeland Security does have its own intelligence capabilities as well, but also, of course, Coast Guard, border security, and so forth. You know, I thought it was a questionable idea to create it at the time. It seemed like you were bringing together very disparate kinds of capabilities that didn't necessarily share a common culture or set of professional expertise or, you know, methods, and that building this organization would be ultimately a time-consuming venture that would distract from the actual work of securing the borders and finding the bad guys and, you know, running the Coast Guard and everything else that's done within that agency. At this point, I don't propose that we undo it. I still think it was a dubious you know, idea. I would have, especially given the difficulty we've had with immigration reform and securing the border since then and the partisan politics that have become associated with that debate, I would rather have used the period right after 9/11 when we had some consensus on these problems to figure out a better strategy for the border and for immigration. And maybe we could have channeled our energy into solving that more specific problem rather than creating this giant, you know, behemoth of disparate capabilities that included, you know, more than a dozen pre-existing agencies, as I recall. But, you know, what's done is done. And I think there are a lot of good people at DHS and they've had some good leaders. And, you know, some of the individual capabilities like the Coast Guard are still essentially run separately and haven't really lost their excellence or their professionalism or their resource base. So on balance, I don't consider it a top tier issue. It was a questionable way to prioritize much of our response back in the day, you know, in 2004 or so when it was created. But at this point, there's probably no huge harm in having it under this form either. And I wouldn't propose that we yet again reinvent it.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us on the Lacouture Reservation. Robert, hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Robert?
Well, for my part, I know a lot of people ain't going to like to hear this, but I do not believe that America is any longer in the right. Any revenge that they were entitled to has long since been dispensed. For one, too many civilians have been killed through the course of this war, and none of them are the responsible parties on either side. Osama was a terrible guy, absolutely. He was just an old man giving orders, just like on the other side. Whatever reasons he had to be angry at this country are his own business. But a lot of the deaths, most of the deaths, I would say, in Afghanistan had been civilians. Any animosity or culture of hatred toward America at this point is America's own fault. If those people are angry, it is not directed at Al-Qaeda or any of the Taliban leaders. It's at the strangers who invaded their country over a guy they never met.
Robert, thanks for the call. Mike Roberts sees the U.S. moral image in Afghanistan hurt by the long-running U.S. military presence there.
Well, he makes a lot of interesting points, some of which I certainly agree with, some of which perhaps less so. Zawahiri, of course, was Egyptian, and he was not implicated directly in this question of what should happen to the future of Afghanistan, except that the previous and current government, the Taliban, had provided him and his Al-Qaeda associates sanctuary. So that's, of course, why we went in after 9/11. The whole war in Afghanistan and whether we should have left, I think it's going to be debated for a long time to come. My view is that it's true there were a lot of civilian casualties, and it's true that in a sense we helped the Afghan government fight the war longer than perhaps it could have without us. So in a sense we helped perpetuate the conflict, but it's also true that the Taliban don't know how to govern the country. And now whatever, you know, solace there might be in having less killing, and that is very important, there, that's largely dominated or, you know, superseded by the huge number of people who are going to die of starvation and privation and disease because the country's not functioning. And so that's the downside to having pulled out and seeing the Taliban regain power. There's less shooting death, but there's a lot more death from just this now being a failed state. And I think we'll all be debating the future of that, you know, well into the future. I'm more interested in seeing, is there a way we can talk to the Taliban and say, if you'll reopen those girls' high schools, if you'll make sure that we have some monitors who can make sure you don't oppress or torture or kill your former opponents or minorities or the Hazara, you know, the Shia group inside of Afghanistan, we will allow you access to your funds and foreign trade to flow and so forth so that you can begin to rescue this economy and the Afghan people. That's where I want to go with the debate. I take your points, Robert, about, you know, this mission we've carried out for 20 years had a lot of downsides to it, was not as successful as it should have been, as many of us, including me, thought it could have been. It was still a much more carefully conducted military operation than, let's say, what we did in Vietnam or what the Soviets did in Afghanistan. And I think we really tried hard to protect civilians. But you're right, there were a lot of casualties and a lot of downsides to our operation there.
Thanks for that call. Kirk joins us now in Madison. Kirk, hello.
Hello. My call is also about the killing of the Al-Qaeda leader. And I ask, is there an ethical problem with assassinating someone in a foreign country?
Kirk, thanks for the call. Mike?
You know, I have to say on this one that I think there was a strategic necessity to show the Taliban that if they work with Al-Qaeda in the future, we will, in a very proportionate and specific way, take action, that we are not going to stand by and let them do again in 2022 what they did in the 1990s into the period before the 2000-2001 attacks. So the ethical question to me has to follow from that strategic analysis. Maybe that's a callous way for me to look at it, but we can't take the risk of another 9/11. And therefore the Taliban, some of them are the same people who ran the place back 25 years ago, or at least, you know, the follow-ons to that leadership generation. They have to know if you mess with Al-Qaeda or other groups that still have ideologies and ambitions to attack the West, we will take action. The Taliban should be grateful. The only guy we killed was Zawahiri. We were very, very careful about that. And I give a lot of credit, obviously, to the men and women of the intelligence community who figured out just where he was and figured out a way to target only him. And I think President Biden made the right decision. I do think it was ethical because it was a guy who's got the blood of several thousand Americans on his hands. And moreover, as I say, there was a strategic importance to showing that we won't be intimidated from taking this kind of action. Therefore, Taliban, take notice. Don't team up with Al-Qaeda again.
Kirk, thanks for that call. And Mike, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow and director of research in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He serves as a member of the Defense Policy Board at the U.S. Department of Defense. His most recent book is called The Art of War in an Age of Peace. He talked to us today about the evolution of U.S. counterterrorism policies in the last two decades. That's in the wake of the recent U.S. drone strike that killed the top Al-Qaeda leader in Afghanistan, in Kabul. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, farmers face economic and environmental uncertainty and threats now and in the near future. But a new report says there is a path to a better future. Check out the findings of the report, Farms Under Threat 2040, Choosing an Abundant Future. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And you can get started right now. If you are a farmer or live in a farming community, love to hear from you with your stories, maybe your thoughts, your hopes for the future, where you see opportunities. Email now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the show tomorrow on The Morning Show. If you've ever wondered what it's like to be your pet, a new video game might offer an answer. A game called Stray lets you wander around the world with a cat's eye view. You guide a cat through daily cat activities, exploring the world, taking naps, knocking things off shelves, I guess, and more. As reported in The Guardian US, the game has human fans and some feline fans, with lots of people posting pictures of their cats watching the screen while they play the game. And by the way, if you have a favorite video game, past or present, on a console, computer, or phone, or from an arcade, we want to hear from you now. We'll invite you to call in tomorrow with your favorites. You can start now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Share a game that you found exciting or soothing. You play it solo or with others. Email ideas@WPR.org. Our own Dean Kinetter is a fan of that cat game. Might get a review from him. Larry Mueller has a story to share, too, about video games. It's video game news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the future of the International Space Station is an open question with deadlines coming up in a couple years and concerns over international cooperation. We'll get the latest from Earth's orbit. Now, the trade deadline for the Major League Baseball season was last night, and the Milwaukee Brewers made a big shakeup this week. They traded their closer, all-star pitcher Josh Hader, to the San Diego Padres in exchange for two Major League pitchers and two minor league prospects. The move got mixed reactions. Some fans question why the team would trade away one of its top relief pitchers while sitting in first place in a division, making another playoff run. Brewers President of Baseball Operations David Stern said the trade is about sustaining success.
Today's trade, as we said in the release, is about doing everything we can as an organization to continue our mission and our goal of giving our team as many bites at the apple as we possibly can to sustain competitiveness and to avoid some of the down cycles that we've seen throughout baseball in the not too distant past.
We're checking out that trade and what's in store for the rest of the Brewers season. Dominic Catriano is a statistician for Bally Sports Wisconsin, host of the Locked On Brewers podcast. Dominic, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I'll ask you the question I'm guessing a lot of Brewers fans are asking. Why this Hader trade?
Well, you know, Brewers fans have been used to hearing Josh Hader's name in trade conversations, it feels like, since 2019 when he first took the closer role. Why now? It's because his value probably was at its peak right now. You give a chance to sell him for a playoff run to a team like the Padres who needs help in the bullpen, and you get to add some prospects. Let's say the worst-case scenario, the Murphy's Law, everything that can go wrong will go wrong, and that, let's say, Hader gets hurt in the second half or he continues his struggles like he had in July. All of a sudden, all that value that you had built up may not quite be there for the Brewers that they knew they were going to have to trade him. The Brewers have always operated as a small-market team, understanding that they're not going to be able to pay superstars like other teams could in the future. And Hader's heading into his final year of his contract next season, in which he's likely to become the richest arbitration-eligible reliever in baseball history. So the Brewers were not excited to make that trade yesterday, and it got an even interesting twist today as one of the big leaguers that returned, Dinelson Lamet, was actually designated for assignment, a.k.a. cut from the roster today.
Now, fans might ask, you know, but we're in a playoff run now. Doesn't this potentially have a downside if the Brewers stay in first place and are trying to go as far as they can into the playoffs?
It's a very fair criticism, and you're losing Josh Hader, who, as many baseball analysts say, is the best closer in baseball. He has been lights out, you know, July aside when he's had a weird month, but he is one of the best in the biz. But to David Stearns and Matt Arnold's credit, the brass of the Brewers front office, they did acquire another closer back in this trade. The other big leaguer is Taylor Rogers. Plenty of big league experience as a closer. In fact, he is second on the National League leaderboard behind Josh Hader for the most saves in baseball in the National League. So it's not like they're bringing in somebody who doesn't have experience. And furthermore, they feel confident to have Devin Williams save multiple games the rest of the season. He has been the guy that closes games when Josh Hader isn't available, like we've seen earlier this year. They are confident with their depth in the bullpen right now. And as we look toward the playoffs, the bullpens are what truly matters. You can have a great starting staff, but it tends to have starting pitchers get yanked a little early in the playoffs. Having a deep bullpen could be a huge key for the Brewers to finally get back to the World Series since the first time since 1982.
Now, for the casual fan who's maybe a little in and out early in the season, now the Brewers are in first place, hoping to stay there. Give us a sense, strengths and weaknesses of the team as they come into the home stretch here.
The strengths of the team is that they have a lot of power. In fact, they're in the top three in all of baseball for home runs hit as a club. They hit three home runs yesterday against the Pirates. They have a lot of power up and down the order. There are plenty of the guys that can hit homers. Three of them already have over 20, Rowdy Tellez, Willy Adames, and Hunter Renfro. Furthermore, they're getting healthier. They've only had a total of something like 17, 18 games all season, in which they've had their main complement of position players that they acquired this offseason healthy and eligible to play in a game. And furthermore, Christian Yelich in the leadoff spot has been a huge boost for the Brewers, finding out that, you know what, maybe the Brewers shouldn't be relying on Christian Yelich for power like we saw in 2018 and 2019, but relying for him getting on base and stealing bases and using his base running ability as opposed to the lack of power he's had. So him in the leadoff spot and the reemergence of health really can keep the Brewers offense going in the right direction. And of course, the strength of the big three of the starting rotation. Corbin Burnes, the reigning Cy Young Award winner. Brandon Woodruff has returned from injury strong. And tonight, we see Freddie Peralta return from injury against the Pittsburgh Pirates. So those three starters, any team in the big leagues would take those three. And the lineup is getting deeper. And health has been a big part of the Brewers all year. And in these final 2 months, looks like they're going to be healthy.
Okay, that sounds pretty rosy. No team is perfect. What are some of the worries that people worry that the Brewers might trip up on the way into the playoffs?
Well, with home runs come strikeouts, and the Brewers are in the top half of the National League in strikeouts as a team. So it's not that surprising to see a lot of strikeouts, but the Brewers work a lot of counts. That's how they build their team. That's how they build their offensive approach. They see the most pitches per plate appearance in baseball. They're a very patient team. They don't chase a lot, But at the same time, they still strike out, swing and miss, pitches in the zone, pitches out of the zone. It doesn't matter. The biggest weakness that will be hurting the Brewers is the bottom half of the order and maybe the lack of depth position player-wise. As we've seen this year, when players are hurt, they don't exactly have replacement-level players ready to go to keep the winning times going. June was a really tough month for the Brewers. They're getting things going again here in the second half, but if there is another injury in these final 59 games, it will be tough for the Brewers to absorb it.
All right, and again, for those casual fans, a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being, eh, whatever, 10 being, get in there now because this is going to be a great year. What number should they be thinking about?
I'd be thinking 7.5. Okay. I know there's been a lot of animosity about this Josh Hader trade and folks worried about, oh my goodness, just traded an all-star closer. But this is still a very exciting team. And as we saw with the Braves last year, they were an under 500 team 100 games into the season, and they won the World Series. All you got to do is get hot at the end of September into October, and anything can happen. Just got to punch your ticket and get into the playoffs. And that's what the Brewers are looking for the rest of the year.
Dominic, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Dominic Catronio, statistician for Bally Sports Wisconsin, host of the Locked On Brewers podcast. He's with us today to break down the Milwaukee Brewers trade of closer Josh Hader and what's in store for the rest of their season. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about kids and their beloved farm animals.
It's peak county fair season in Wisconsin. For many children at the Dane County Fair, it's more than the tilt-a-whirl and deep-fried treats. The event showcases all their hard work as they show their arts and crafts and animals, ranging from the smallest guinea pigs to the fully grown beef cattle. Christina Leffring spoke with some of the children about the lessons learned.
Go to any county fair and there's a lot going on. The rides, the food, and the music. But personally, I'm a sucker for the 4-H animal shows. In one morning at the Dane County Fair, I saw 12-year-old Brooklyn Carlson give her duck Biscuit a bath. 18-year-old Leah Hutchhausen was shearing her sheep, Steve. And 9-year-old Layla Merrill led her massive, fully grown cow she's nicknamed Steamy after a special gift the cow gave her one cold morning. And I got an earful from Monopoly, the dairy cow who wants all the attention.
Yeah, she's quite the talker.
That's Morgan Cooper from Sun Prairie. Monopoly is not hers, but is tied up on the same row with the other DeForest 4-H Club's dairy cattle, including Morgan's calf, Elvira.
She is a very special animal to me, and I kind of call her like my puppy sometimes because she just follows me around, and she's really sweet.
Morgan is 17, so she is about to age out of the program. She's learned a lot about public speaking, community service, and the hard work that goes into training an animal.
I've been working with her for a couple of months now, and it for sure started very, very bad. She was definitely a little on the crazy side, but I think just spending time with them and having that bond, it brings happiness to people, honestly.
And Morgan's almost an adult. Kids can start showing dairy calves when they're as young as 9, like Abby Janish from DeForest, who showed for the first time with her calf, Daphne.
She normally is sweet, but she can get really sassy. She won't listen to me where I won't be able to hold her head up. Getting loose like 3 times, try to run me into buildings. Machinery.
Have you enjoyed raising her though?
Yes.
Even with all her attitude?
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because we both have attitude.
Showing farm animals is seen as an activity mainly for kids living on farms, but that's not true these days. Not many of the kids with the DeForest 4-H Club are growing up in the country, much less on a working farm, even though many of their parents did. Abby's family is an exception. She lives across the street from her grandparents' dairy farm. And her mom, Vicki Janish, describes their home as a funny farm, with beef cattle, pigs, and chickens. But she and other area farmers make room on their farms for area kids to keep their show animals.
That's what's really cool about 4-H, is that it's a melting pot for opportunities. So if a child has interest in pigs or dairy or goats or sheep or whatever it may be, there's somebody in their local community that they can talk to and learn from. So we have 3 kids showing from our farm, we're giving them the opportunity to do what they are interested in.
Abby went a step further. She grew vegetables in a garden and sold them at a roadside stand so she could buy one of her 2 pigs she's showing, named Latte and Pumpkin Spice. And just like how her family helps kids who want to learn about dairy cattle, her neighbors taught her about pigs.
We don't know anything about pigs, so the families that are in our community really rallied behind her, and so that's what we get to do in the dairy side too, is we're trying to mentor and educate and expand their knowledge about agriculture.
After the fair, Abby will keep latte for breeding, but pumpkin spice will be sold for meat, which is another important lesson. How to let go of the animals they've raised.
Are you sad about losing one of your pigs?
No, not really.
What helped you prepare for letting one of your pigs go?
Thinking of brats.
Another important lesson?
What?
Know where your favorite food comes from.
What?
Christina Laffring brought us that story from the Dane County Fair. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a space policy expert explains what's going on with Russia's plans for the International Space Station. Some panicky headlines about the future of the station, but she says we need some clarification on that. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Cooperation between the U.S. and Russia is difficult these days after the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the American role in leading the international effort to supply arms and other aid to the Ukrainian military. Do those difficulties extend into space and the International Space Station in particular? A lot of headlines last week suggested a big change of Russian policy and a threat by Russia's space agency to abruptly leave the space station in 2024. But our next guest says, hang on. The Russian space agency was pretty much confirming things we already knew, including the expiration of the current plans to keep the station going through 2024. Plus, it's been up in the air for years whether Russia will commit to staying longer. Well, there's a good chance that other ISS partnering countries will. It gets complicated. Our next guest is here to sort things out about what's going on in orbit. Marcia Smith is the founder and editor of SpacePolicyOnline.com. She has more than four decades of experience in space policy, including at the Congressional Research Service, the Space Studies Board, and the Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Marcia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
So, yeah, some of those initial headlines, pretty panicky. What was really going on with this statement from Russian Space Administration leaders?
Well, the Russian Space Agency, Roscosmos, has a new leader. On July 15th, the guy who was running it, Dmitry Rogozin, who was a very bombastic fellow and often threatened to leave the ISS, was replaced by Yuri Borisov. And Borisov met with Putin and they made it public, which is unusual. And he said to Putin that, according to the reports from Russia, that Russia was going to leave the space station after 2024. But that got reported outside of Russia that they were going to leave in 2024, which is very different. And so there were all these headlines about Russia was going to be leaving precipitously, which caused a lot of concern because the space station really is an interdependent facility, a Russian part and an American part that really need to work together. But it was a misunderstanding of what he was saying. And he did an interview with Russian TV a couple of days later to clarify that he just meant they were going to be leaving after 2024. And everyone's going to be leaving after 2024.
Right. Talk about that timeline. What is significant about after 2024 for the International Space Station?
So the International Space Station has been there for quite some time. It's been permanently occupied by crews, international crews, including Russians and Americans, for over 20 years. So it's getting old. Everybody knows it's getting old. And right now, all the partners, that's Russia, the United States, Canada, Japan, and Europe, have agreed to operate it through 2024. But the United States is trying to get everybody to agree to keep it going till 2030, hoping that by then there'll be new commercial space stations where people can continue their research. So the United States is leading this effort to get everybody agree to 2030. And we have now made that commitment. We made it twice. President Biden announced it on December 31st. And then Congress has just passed a law last week in law extending the U.S. commitment to 2030. And Canada and Japan and Europe are all expected to agree also. But Russia has been an outlier. They haven't been willing to come forward and say, yes, we're definitely staying until 2030. So that's why there's a little bit of concern about what their plans are.
Right. Given, the resources all the different parties bring to the table here, can the space station be maintained until 2030 without Russia involved?
It would be extremely difficult. It is an interdependent facility. And among the things, for example, is that on the Russian side of it, they have propulsion. You have to lift the space station up in orbit periodically because the atmosphere drags it down. So you have to do these periodic reboosts, and you have to move the space station to avoid space debris from time to time. And the propulsion to do that is on the Russian end. And the US segment, it has the electrical power. It has these gigantic solar arrays that provide electrical power for the space station. So it's just two examples of how it's interdependent, but it'd be very difficult for us to replace the Russian propulsion capability. NASA says that it has some contingency plans in the works, but they haven't made them public. And it's not quite clear what they could get ready in time if Russia were to leave as early as 2024.
We're talking to Marcia Smith from spacepolicyonline.com, looking at the International Space Station, its future, and international cooperation there. Marcia, there are lots of things floating around in orbit. There are lots of satellites. This one has humans on it, though, which makes it very distinctive. What is the argument for having, you know, people in a station of some sort, whether it's the ISS or something TBD after it?
Well, there's a lot of research that really requires human involvement. There's some that you can do without it, but there's a lot that you really need to have a scientist right there, just like we do here on Earth. So they're doing research that will benefit both people here on Earth and people who want to go further in space. So right now, the United States and some of its other partners are planning a return to the moon and someday to go on to Mars. And if you're going to have humans doing that, then you need to understand how they react to long durations in weightlessness and the kind of, you know, conditions that you have in space flight. So it's really two-pronged. One is to do the scientific research that really requires having an on-site presence of a human being, and also to study how humans react, because humans are going to explore beyond Earth orbit.
And you mentioned the ISS. Even if we go to 2030, it's old. It's not going to be there forever. What kind of plans are in the works for future space stations?
So NASA is hoping that commercial companies are going to come forward and build their own space stations. NASA is going to facilitate it. They're going to provide some of the money, but they want to do it as public-private partnerships. NASA has gone all in on public-private partnerships. That's how they did the commercial crew program for taking astronauts back and forth to the space station, SpaceX's Crew Dragon. That was done as a public-private partnership. They do it with cargo. They're doing it for many aspects of the Artemis program to go back to the moon. And for space stations, they're going to do the same thing. So they basically are going to help companies. There are four companies that they're working with right now to build much smaller space stations. And NASA will just rent the capacity that it needs from them. So NASA won't own it. They'll just buy whatever services they need. And those companies, they're working on their designs. They seem very confident they're going to have something ready by the late part of this decade or 2030. And that's why 2030 is sort of this big marker as to when NASA wants to transition away from owning this kind of a space facility to just leasing whatever it needs. And other users will lease the rest of the capacity.
Now, the International Space Station, I think at some points has been seen as a symbol of, hey, sometimes even if we can't get along here on Earth, we can find ways to work together up there in space. Are you hopeful, maybe even just at that symbolic level, that there can be this kind of international cooperation, not just amongst allies, but even adversaries when it comes to something like this in orbit?
I think that that is one of the signature accomplishments of the ISS, is keeping this partnership together over all these years. The space station program started in 1984, and Russia came in 1993, and it's had a lot of ups and downs over these decades. And the geopolitical relationship has been changing over those decades, not just right now with the current invasion of Ukraine, but in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. So there have been a lot of ups and downs, and this has been one little segment of geopolitical cooperation that has stayed the course. And I think there are a lot of people who are hopeful that it's going to continue to be able to stay out of the terrestrial geopolitical realm. It hasn't been 100%. When Rogozin was still running Roscosmos, he had the three cosmonauts who were up there wave flags for the two republics in Ukraine that Russia is claiming. And that was not good. NASA responded to that saying it was inappropriate to do that. So maybe with Rogozin gone and Borisov taking it over, we won't see any more of that.
Marcia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Marcia Smith, founder and editor of spacepolicyonline.com. She's got years of experience in space policy. She talked to us today about Russia's commitment to the International Space Station, the future of the ISS, and other potential orbital stations, and some confusion that came out from Russian announcements and the coverage here in the United States about the future of the space station. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Kansas voters blocked an attempt to change their state's constitution. That change would have allowed a ban on abortions. Look at the decision, the margin among voters there, and what it might mean for abortion politics around the country in these midterm elections in 2022. And higher education is becoming a political football. How did it get that way? The author of a new book breaks down the cultural and political divides around college and the history that led us here. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.